You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. In addition to being a professor at Barnard College, astrophysicist Jana Levin is also the director of science at Brooklyn's Pioneer Works, a center for art and innovation where she works alongside artists and musicians. Levin believes that science is an absolutely intrinsic part of culture, a belief she so gracefully demonstrates in her latest book, now out in paperback, Black Hole Blues and Other Songs from Outer Space. Levin chronicles the dramatic history of the LIGO, Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. I think I did it. Thank you very much. Experiment, from its conception in the 1960s to its recent and triumphant detection of gravitational waves, ripples in space-time coming from the distant merger of two black holes, which I say as if I completely understand what that means. If astrophysics is a black hole to you, as it is to me, then reading Jana's book will draw you into the orbit of remarkably scrappy scientists who are obsessed with what Levin herself calls, quote, this abstracted, arduous, difficult to understand thing, which I think is a great. The narrative of the book is driven by the looming possibility of failure. But in taking the risk to write about the immense risks being taken by generations of scientists, Levin has written a great story of the human spirit, the story of scientists who have dedicated their careers to trying to record the music of the universe. The book is, as the New Statesman proclaimed, quote, a near-perfect balance of science, storytelling, and insight, unquote. And it's really cool. It really is. Dr. Levin's other books include How the Universe Got Its Spots and a novel, A Madman Dreams of Turing Machines, which won the Penn Bingham Award. She was recently, in the last few years, a Guggenheim Fellow. And in conversation with Jana Levin tonight is Sean Carroll, a theoretical physicist from Caltech Institute of Technology. And he is really, really good at showing how thought alone cannot bend spoons. I have seen him do this. His research focuses on fundamental physics and cosmology. No lab, he once told me, just a pencil and a pad of paper. Sean is the author of The Particle at the End of the Universe and From Eternity to Here, The Quest for the Ultimate Theory of Time. We love having him here on the Aloud stage. He recently won the Winton Prize from the Royal Society of London. So please join me in welcoming Sean Carroll and Jana Levin to the stage of the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Thanks, Louise. It's always great to be here back at the LA Public Library, and especially great to be here on stage with Jana Levin, who I've known for over half of my existence here on Earth. We didn't quite go to graduate school together in the traditional sense, but we were one or two subway stops away from each other in Cambridge, Massachusetts, when we went to graduate school. And we actually met on the subway and ended up spending late nights doing problem sets in quantum field theory and general relativity together. And meanwhile, like, we've grown up to be scientists and writers of books and have had many conversations and laughs along the way. And now Jana has a book out. Show them the book, Jana. There you go. Black Hole Blues. You can buy it and you get
it
signed.
I'm not holding it just as an advertisement.
No, but you
I'm
could
actually
buy
gonna
it.
Do something with
you
it.
You could buy it right now on Amazon without leaving your seat. And so we thought that the most sensible thing to do just to start the evening would be to have Jana read from the beginning of the book.
Okay, so I don't read a lot from, I mean, I read a lot. I don't read from my books a lot, so I hope you'll bear with me, but this was, and Louise had this suggestion, I thought it was really sweet just to get a flavor of the book. So this is the very opening of the book, and I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. I'll let you know when I'm doing that. Somewhere in the universe, two black holes collide, as heavy as stars, as small as cities, literally black, the complete absence of light, holes, empty hollows. Tethered by gravity in their final seconds together, the black holes course through thousands of revolutions about their eventual point of contact, churning up space and time until they crash and merge into one bigger black hole, an event more powerful than any since the origin of the universe, outputting more than a trillion times the power of a billion suns. The black holes collide in complete darkness. None of the energy exploding from the collision comes out as light. No telescope will ever see the event. That profusion of energy emanates from the coalescing holes in a purely gravitational form, as waves in the shape of space-time, as gravitational waves. An astronaut floating nearby would see nothing, but the space she occupied would ring, deforming her, squeezing, then stretching. If close enough, her auditory mechanism could vibrate in response. She would hear the wave. In empty darkness, she could hear space-time ring, barring death by black hole. Gravitational waves are like sounds without a material medium. When a black hole collides, they make a sound. No human has ever heard the sound of a gravitational wave. No instrument has indisputably recorded one. Traveling from the impact as fast as light to the Earth could take a billion years, and by the time the gravitational wave gets from the black hole collision to this planet, the din of the crash is imperceptibly faint, fainter than that, quieter than can be described with conventional superlatives. By the time the gravitational wave gets here, the ringing of space will involve relative changes in distance, the width of an atomic nucleus over a stretch comparable to the span of three Earths. I'm going to skip ahead to the end of this chapter. Under the gloom of a controversial beginning and the opposition of powerful scientists, grievous internal battles and arduous technical dilemmas, LIGO recovered and grew, hitting projections and escalating in capability. 5 decades after the experimental ambition began, we are on the eve of the crash of a colossal machine into a wisp of a sound. An idea sparked in the 1960s, a thought experiment, an amusing haiku, is now a thing of metal and glass. Advanced LIGO began to record the skies in the fall 2015, a century after Einstein published his mathematical description of gravitational waves. The instruments should reach optimum sensitivity within a year or two, maybe three. The early generation of machines proved the concept, but still success is never guaranteed. Nature doesn't always comply. The advanced machines will lock on and tolerate adjustments and corrections and calibrations and wait for something extraordinary to happen, while the scientists push aside their doubts and press toward the finish. As much as this book is a chronicle of gravitational waves, a sonic record of the history of the universe, a soundtrack to match the silent movie, it is a tribute to a quixotic, epic, harrowing, experimental endeavor, a tribute to a fool's ambition. Thanks. Thank you.
I want you to remind you, like, her day job is a physicist, not a writer. So that was that's wonderful. And so just to set the stage a little bit here, Jana, like, you didn't build LIGO yourself, right?
No, God, yeah. So I am very much not an experimental physicist. And like you, I'm a pen and paper calculating physicist. It doesn't mean manipulative. That means we like to calculate things. And I became so enamored, I think, of the physicality of the experiment. And that they were the gall, like the confidence to build something. And even that line, you know, of metal and glass, I mean, that's really how it struck me. I think that I kind of had like a crush on the experiment. But no, I did not build LIGO. I am not even part of the collaboration. I have never signed on to the collaboration. But I do, you know, my theoretical work is inspired by LIGO.
Right. And this thing you didn't build, like, where is it?
Okay, so there's two machines. There's I'm going this weekend. So there's one instrument in Hanford, Washington, which is the machines are nearly identical. They're 4-kilometer-long instruments. They span 4 kilometers. And the other machine is in Louisiana, in a parish of what used to be maybe 800 people, Livingston Parish in Louisiana, which is outside Baton Rouge. And they're intended to be remote so that they're not disturbed by, you know, noise and trucks and cars. They're very, very delicate. They can measure earthquakes in China from here.
What? Yeah. So how do they measure anything? Is it like a big rubber band?
So,
I know the answers to some of these questions.
I know.
I'm just trying to.
It's like a sitcom where you have to deliver the lines. Yeah. So the idea is that, so let's say two black holes collide. and they create ripples in the shape of space-time. So what does that really mean? That means that if you were in orbit around these two black holes, your orbit would, like, bob. You would literally bob on the wave like a buoy in the ocean. And so what LIGO does, this great haiku that somebody thought of, this guy Ray Weiss, when he was just trying to imagine how you would measure these things, was the idea that you would suspend mirrors as delicately as possible so that they would bob on the wave if a gravitational wave passed. And so LIGO is like this huge, almost musical instrument designed to just measure the bobbing of the mirrors on the wave. And so there are this L-shaped instrument, they're 4 kilometers long on each arm of the L, and the mirrors are suspended at the ends and at the apex, and there's a laser that shines down the arms that just tries to keep track of where the mirrors are. And that's the whole game. And the mirrors are suspended by these incredibly delicate... Have you ever seen the glass fibers?
I have not.
They're stunning. It's so crazy.
I don't want to lose my credibility as a theoretical physicist.
Yeah. So. Well, they don't let me near anything, realize. Like, they practically tape my hands down when they let me into the lab. But you can break these fibers if you flick them with your fingers. They're so delicate. And they're holding these, like, 40-kilogram mirrors. But the mirrors are completely transparent to optical light, to the light that the human eye can see. So they're mirrors, but they're invisible to the human eye, practically. But in the wavelength of the laser, they're like 99.999% reflective.
Infrared, ultraviolet, what is the...
You know, I don't remember the exact wavelength of the... Yeah, okay. I assume it's an IR infrared, but I don't remember the exact wavelength. But the laser, you know, is an important component of the instrumental design and the power of it.
So you're just waiting for a gravitational wave from a black hole to come in.
Right.
And it jiggles your mirrors.
It jiggles your mirrors.
And how do you know that it's not just a tree falling in the woods?
So there unfortunately are a lot of trees falling in the woods around Louisiana. It actually was a site that was selected that I don't know if they cared or they knew what was going on, but it was it's a log. There's an actual logging company that's felling trees. And there was this one, so yes, a tree falls, yeah. And the mirror rings. And so they were going crazy about this source of noise, right? Ray himself, who is one of the great architects of this machine, who we all hope will get the Nobel Prize imminently, would drive around at like 4 a.m. to figure out what was going on. And he saw them logging the trees. I think they didn't realize they were logging so frequently. And they were logging like in the middle of the night. And so he would run back to he would call the control room and be like, watch the instrument. And if a tree fell, boom, it would go like, yeah. But you have to realize that
they detected trees long before they detected black holes.
That's right. If the tree falls in the forest.
They heard it.
But I'm bummed, yeah.
So why do we care about gravitational waves? Like, are they the best waves or are they
just
different?
The best.
All right, well, that answers that. Who invented this idea, this cockamamie scheme?
So, as you well know, Einstein writes down his general theory of relativity. It's 1915 when he finally succeeds in writing down his greatest accomplishment. And this greatest accomplishment describes the curvature of space and time in the presence of mass and energy. And he realizes it's a very simple idea. You know, if the sun is curving space enough for the Earth to fall on a circle, what happens if the sun moves? That circle better follow the sun, right? And nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, including information about the location of the sun. And he theorizes that there must be these ripples in the shape of space-time that propagate outward at the speed of light and communicate to the Earth, the sun has moved. You better catch up and go back to your orbit or something's going to happen. You know, you fall on a new line. You fall on a new curve, basically. But he didn't really understand gravitational waves. I'm giving this incredibly intuitive description that we only have with tremendous hindsight. He starts writing papers as soon as 1916. He says the most important thing he needs to understand is whether or not gravitational waves exist. He gets a letter from Carl Schwarzschild from the trenches during the war describing black holes. He says, that's cute, but you know, these things are, nature will never allow this to happen. Much more important, he says, are gravitational waves. And he starts writing papers back and forth. They exist, they don't exist. He contradicts himself. He writes a paper 1 year saying they exist, the next year they don't exist, a couple years later they don't exist again. And between acceptance and press, he sneaks in a different paper, says that they do exist, right? So this battle went on for decades. And by the time the original architects of this machine started dreaming of this idea in the 70s, okay, the 70s, this is 60 years later, they still didn't know if gravitational waves were real.
Wow.
And the important thing, I think, for us to take away is that it's not light. This is not looking at the universe. We're not taking pictures. This is literally recording something. It's a recording that comes back. And that is unlike anything we've ever done before.
So will there be gravitational wave iPhones?
Yeah,
use this?
I'm really surprised it's not a ringtone yet. Aren't you sort of like...
But I mean, can we put this to technological use? We now have a new way of making waves.
Yes, but the mirrors are moving in response to what, as in the opening paragraph, is the most powerful event detected since the Big Bang, moved by less than 1/10,000th the width of a proton.
So
and over common. 4 kilometers.
Yeah.
Okay, so they have to measure the difference between 4 kilometers and 4 kilometers plus or minus 1/10,000th the width of a proton. And that is why LIGO took 50 years and was such an intense technical challenge. The first generation of machines was built in the year 2000, and presumably those two black holes that collided were colliding back then. They might have been colliding for a billion years. And that even that superb instrument, that beautiful proof of concept, and that fantastic technological achievement was not able to detect the black hole collision. And so 15 years later, they're installing the advanced machine, and they don't know if they're going to get anything. You know, they don't know if they're going to get anything at all. Ray said to me in August of 2015, if we don't detect black holes, this thing is a failure, you know.
And they know that it's black holes they found? Like, what kind of black holes are we talking
about? So a month after Ray says this, the most remarkable thing happens. You know, the LIGO instrument's not ready yet. They're
so
postponing
when is
their
this?
Science. This is September 2015. It's September 14th that Monday. They were going to start the science run, but they had to postpone because they just didn't feel they were ready. So it's the middle of the night, and all the experimentalists on both sites are intentionally jabbing at the machine. They're trying to screw it up to see where the noise is coming from or what's going wrong. They're like literally like basically banging on it. Like they're driving trucks and slamming on the brakes to see if the mirrors wobble. They're doing all this crazy stuff. And they finally they just give up. They decide, this is crazy. We're going home. Put down their tools. They go home in Louisiana. They do the same thing in Hanford, Washington. And within the span of an hour, 100 years, really, in the centenary of Einstein's theory, this signal comes from the southern sky. You know, it's a billion years old. It comes from the southern sky. It rings the machine in Louisiana. It's recorded. And then
the whole thing lasts?
It's 1/5 of a second. And you can literally time it cruising across the continent before it hits the machine in Washington State and is recorded. And they wake up at 8:30 in the morning. And, you know, Ray's like, what the hell is this? It's like been captured by a law, you know. And they didn't believe it was real, actually, is their first response. They start accusing
each other. They had this wonderful
strategy,
right,
yeah.
of making sure they were not tricked?
Yeah.
Like fooling themselves?
They had a system called a blind injection system, which was of the 800 experimentalists, two or three at a time were given permission to secretly inject a false signal into the data. And all the experimentalists, nobody would be told for months. They did this once before. There was an incident called Big Dog, because it was in the direction of the constellation. Is it Canis Minor? Is that the right one?
One of those dogs.
Come on.
Yeah.
You look at the sky.
Yeah. Canis Major. Canis,
Canis
Minor.
Major. It was Major, wasn't it? Yeah. Big Dog. That would be Major, not Minor. So
physics major.
So
yeah.
They, not astronomy. Not astronomy majors. So they, for months, analyzed the signal, the 800 people in the experiment, having to take it as though it was real, analyzed the signal, come to a conclusion of what it was. They go to a big meeting, and it's revealed, ha-ha, just kidding. It was just a blind injection. So on that morning, Mike Landry, who's the head of the Hanford Observatory, on the morning of September 14th, when the real signal hit, was really pissed. He's like, I cannot believe they're doing blind injections. What are they doing? And so he goes to the Monday morning meeting at 8:30 a.m., and he starts to say to one of the blind injectors, one of the two people that are allowed to do this, you know, what are you guys doing? We're not ready yet. We're like not even ready for a science run. And the guy looks like, he looks kind of like, stone-faced. And Mike starts, he's not allowed to be told, right? So he starts asking questions.
That
like,
clearly sounds like cheating a little bit.
No, so he's only allowed to ask certain questions. He's not allowed to ask, did you do a blind injection? But he finally lands on the right question. The question he asks is, are we in a blind injection phase? And the guy says, no. And Mike goes like, what? And so he's on a call at 8:30 in the morning to this international team, and all he can say is, hey, everybody, you guys need to listen to this. We're not in a blind injection phase. Just and everyone just goes like, boom.
Wow.
Like you can hear a pin drop. Yeah.
And how did we eventually figure out that it was black holes rather than...
Well, so it's 3 months of analyzing the data, and yeah. It's just like, how do you know it's your ringtone? You have a familiarity with it, right? So we've spent decades predicting what it sounds like when black holes collide. Very, very good predictions. So good that that we can reconstruct the shape and size of the mallets, if you think of the black holes as mallets, from the ringing of the drum, if you think of space-time as the drum. And we can reconstruct how they were moving, how big they were, how fast they were, and they have all the markers of black holes.
So there's a lot more black holes out there than we thought?
Well, this is stunning, because if you talked to the experimental team at that time, they all would have said, no black holes for years. That's what everybody told me, except Kip Thorne. Kip Thorne was the only one who's like, black holes are going to be first. He's literally the only one. Everyone else was like, black holes not until 2018, 2019, if we're lucky.
What else would they see?
Dead stars like neutron stars, which weren't massive enough to make it all the way to a black hole, stopped under the collapse phase. Still real objects, very dense, very small, 20 kilometers across, very intense, but not black holes. And we thought we'd detect two neutron stars ringing, spinning around each other, or a supernova, a star exploding in its death throes. And nobody except Kip thought black holes would
be. But that's why you do it, right? Because you want to be surprised.
And they're big. The black holes, it's not just the first time we've recorded gravitational waves. It's not just the first time we've detected two black holes in orbit together. It's not just the first time that we've detected black holes that are dark, right? There's no telescope that can see these. There's no light coming out of it.
As opposed to, right. There are black holes that are not dark.
There are black holes that are not dark because they're cannibalizing stuff around them and creating mayhem, and we see the mayhem. We don't see the black hole. We see the mayhem. And this is the first time that a completely dark black hole was detected. And more power came out of this event than any since the Big Bang. It was more power coming out than all the stars in the observable universe combined, shining in light. And it was dark. So that is really intense. And the gravity is weak, and so by the time it gets here, it's this little wisp.
Petered out, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And they were big. That was another point, is that they were big. They're nearly 30 times the mass of the sun, and that was bigger than anticipated. And that's why there's been all these black hole discoveries, because the black holes are bigger than we expected, which makes them louder.
Where does a 30 times the mass of the sun black hole come from?
That's great, because now we're doing regular old astronomy. People are trying to figure out where does a black hole, the 30 times the mass of the sun come from, because that was not predicted.
Yeah.
And there are arguments. Some people think they're primordial. They come from the beginning of the universe. Some people think that we didn't understand collapse well enough in all the detailed, grungy nuclear physics. And some people think they merged already before. They were smaller black holes that got
little
bigger.
Little black holes got big, yeah.
Yeah.
So you somehow managed to become an embedded journalist.
That was so weird.
Sweet talked all these physicists into spilling their guts to you.
My God, I have no idea. People like telling me stuff. It's really weird. Cab drivers love to tell me stuff.
So tell us some of the personalities.
Uber drivers. I'm really close with a number of Uber drivers. Ray Weiss, Kip Thorne, Ron Drever, who I never met and passed away this year, but was alive for the discovery. Probably would have been a recipient of the Nobel Prize had he lived another year. Those were the three main characters. But they were, so Ray Weiss, who I've already mentioned a couple of times, was this young professor at MIT who started a whole gravity experimental group, and the MIT asks him to teach general relativity. And he does not know general relativity. He's like, I can't say no. I can't tell them. I don't know general relativity. So he says he was bumbling. He says, I was one day ahead of the students, but they didn't walk out. And they didn't walk out because he kept dreaming of ways to make it concrete. What is this whole curved space time thing about? And this LIGO experiment was his haiku, and it was his dream, and he thought of this way of imagining the curved space time and the mirrors floating, and the class loved it. It's 1972 or something like that, and he starts to build one. And Ray is just an incredible story, just an incredible person. He describes how when he was 15, he wanted to make music easier to hear. You know, and then here he is at 83, and he's recorded, you know, the sounds from space. Like, it's sort of this beautiful. And he swears a lot. And I suppressed a lot of the swearing. Like, I think I only allowed Ray
to
swear.
So as a reader,
like,
we should interpolate some swears.
There's a lot more swearing
that
goes on. And then Kip Thorne, who's just a gem of a human being, who is a famous astrophysicist and a total dreamer, and who you know very well, I know very well, is just, I think, really influenced probably both our careers a lot, just through sheer inspiration. Real creative genius. And then Ron Drever, who was this really kooky character, this intuitive experimentalist who would just see solutions that nobody else could see. It was just a fascinating character. So, yeah, it's really about the Mount Everest climb.
But there's a theme, sort of a subtext theme running throughout your book of people getting fired and or humiliated.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of firing and a lot of humiliation. It is an arduous project, right? It doesn't. It's not well perceived in the astronomy community at all.
Now it is.
Okay, as of post February 11th, when they made the public announcement, 2016, it obviously has transformed. Prior to that, it was not a well regarded operation. It was considered too expensive, too unlikely to succeed. Everybody said it would not succeed. I mean, not everybody. Lots of very reliable, very smart people said it was never going to succeed.
I was always
a big
fan.
And they said it in 2015.
But I remember inviting people to give talks about LIGO, and they would show the plot. Here we are now. This is where we're going to get.
Yeah.
Go get to. And afterward, the audience members would come up to me and go, like, they're crazy. They'll never do it.
Yeah, they're crazy. Yeah. And I think they were crazy. They were a little crazy. So
why would they get fired?
Well, God, so many people got fired. It was so bad. I mean, even Ray describes getting no money, being turned down for all his grants, working on a very modest budget, almost in secret, in this ramshackle structure on the periphery of the MIT campus, when his colleagues are telling him, you're not going to get tenure. They would say things like, your instrument is so bad, if the sun blew up, you couldn't record it. And they would say, I could do better looking out the window. And he was like, God damn it, they're right. You could literally do better looking out the window.
But he didn't get fired.
He didn't get fired. So people who got fired was, like, Robbie Vogt got fired. Robbie Vogt was one of the first director of LIGO. Robbie is an incredible character. So at Caltech right now, there is a building, which is mostly the LIGO building. And at the far end of that hallway is a huge Regal office, which is haunted by Robbie Vogt, and Robbie was fired 25 or 30 years ago from the experiment, but still haunts that office. And he hasn't spoken to many of his LIGO colleagues in those two or three decades.
So he comes into the office.
He comes into the office, doesn't talk to anybody, and he leaves. And he's a big fella. He's a really big fella, German immigrant, and just came from, like, really brutal story of his survival during the war. He was a prisoner of war. A German prisoner of war, and when he came to Caltech, he thought of Caltech as his country. You know, he thought of his own country as so oppressive. You know, he was a prisoner of war under Americans. Like, he did not mentally align himself with countries. He aligned himself with Caltech and science. And then he's the one who really got LIGO onto a secure footing from this obscure experiment that was failing and not getting grants and waffling and, to some extent, in disrepute. And he brings the experiment to fruition in terms of financing it, getting NSF on board. He's lobbying Congress. I mean, the man is a complete force of nature. When I went to go meet him, people were, like, worried about me. They were like, you're going to go speak to whom? Like, I was standing outside the LIGO building, like, little me and big Robbie Vogt, and he's talking really intensely, and people were just, like, wide-eyed and skirting around us and, like, going into the building. So Robbie was eventually fired, and he was fired even though what he did was so important and deserves the credit that it does get in the history, but he was fired basically because he didn't trust anybody, and he wouldn't. He did a kind of skunk works where he didn't believe in delegating power, and he didn't believe even in tolerating the opinions of the funding agency that was giving him several hundred million dollars.
Yeah.
And he would scream at the funders, and he was like, it's an intense dude.
It brings up the fact that to shepherd an experiment like this...
He's not here, is he, Robbie? Here?
Yeah. There's a lot of skills involved that are not necessarily what you're trained for.
But also his personal story somehow frames what happened to him. He discusses his intense contempt and distrust of authority from his own experience under the Nazi regime. And so that's why he can't tolerate authority, anybody's own. Right. And he says this line to me. So I really tried to make the book read novelistic, where the people deliver their lines. And he said something like, you asked me if I strove for power or something like that. You know, and he would say, like, you know, power corrupts. You know, and I think he's still very wounded to have been tossed off the LEGO project. I think it hurt him. A lot of people never recovered from that.
Right. And even Ron Drever was
fired.
Out.
So Ron Drever, many people consider to be an absolute experimental genius. So much of what Ron dreamt up is in the final design of the instrument. But Ron also would not delegate. That it started as this tiny operation. You know, first it was just Ray Kipp and Ron and Robbie. There were like 5 people, then 10 people, and that was it for like decades. And then now there's 1,000. Right? So to go from that to 1,000 required people be able to delegate responsibility and allow other people to build the instrument. Ron kept changing his mind. He would build it one day and the next day undo everything and start over again. And there was this terrible battle between Robbie and Ron. And it ended with Robbie basically throwing Ron off the project. But Ron was a Scottish physicist. He was not of this world. He was like a different kind of a character altogether. And all he had was LIGO. He didn't even understand what was happening. Like he basically didn't leave the collaboration. So there was this very painful clash between them, which ends with Ron being removed. And Ron disappears from the history books. I fought to get Ron's story released. Like I didn't meet Ron. Ron was not well for the past few years. He had dementia and he was not, you know, connected and you couldn't interview him.
Right.
And there were these tapes that existed from the late 90s, like 5-6 hours of tape. And the first hour of tape, he would say something like, I'm about to get to the story. And then it would be like the 4th hour of tape and the 5th hour of tape and the 6th hour of tape. And but they weren't released from the Caltech archives. They wouldn't release the tapes.
But you got to listen.
Because I had to hunt down the brother in Scotland. And I had to get the brother to give me permission to listen to the tapes, for the release of the tapes. And his brother's this affable character, warm, chatty, and not at all like what Ron sounds like. And he describes being 3 years Ron's junior and really being given the assignment of taking care of him most of his life, like making sure he would get to school or that he would be where he was supposed to be. But Ron was this genius. You know, he was this Mozart. Sort of character.
And you were very explicit in your hopes to bring the human people to life.
Yeah.
To tell the story, as you say, almost novelistically, narratively. Yeah. Is that, you know, should we all be doing that? Is that how science books are written? Is that just right for this?
No, don't do that. That's my thing, man. That's like my thing. No, so I started writing a very different book. And I was terrified of writing it this way. I was really worried about offending people. I was really worried that some of these people are my friends and I'm not going to say 100% things in their favor. And it was awful. So the first draft, I buried most of these things.
Right.
And it was a total mess. And I knew it was a mess. And I was having like panic attacks. And then I realized I just had to throw out most of the book and just think about it as these characters in a novel. Like I would read as inspiration, like you can read the opening of like The Human Stain, Anyone read Roth's The Human Stain? It's about an academic. That's why I would read the opening. It's about this academic whose life goes awry. And I was like, that's what I'm doing. I'm writing a book about these academics whose lives go awry. And so it really becomes Ray's voice. You know, Ray is there, and then there's Kip, and then there's Ron. It takes a totally different turn for me. And once I committed to that, the book takes off. I mean, for me, in terms of writing it. I mean, in terms of the ease of writing it. It went from being a nightmare,
right,
disaster, car crash, to being like, oh, I know what I'm doing now.
Is that just your book writing style? Does that happen with all the books?
That's how I run my life, basically. Yeah,
yeah. That's good.
Yeah, it's like a metaphor for life. But the thing about the people is that when I gave the book, on the day that the detection came, I happened to print final draft, or you know, first drafts of the book, two, one for Ray and one for Kip. And I send it to them, not knowing that this has happened. And they're like scientists to the end. Like Ray would read it and he'd be like, God damn it, I don't like it, but it's true. And then he would say like, yes, that's what happened, but it doesn't have to be in your book. You know, and then
he told you.
Yeah. But at no point did they ask me to change a word.
Right.
And they were just like total ethical scientists
to
the end.
Yeah.
Totally. Like the most Ray would say is like, yeah, that was my favorite line. God damn it, I don't like it, but it's true. And then Kip would say, yes, yes, that person said that, yes, the person said it, but I have this counter argument. He would show me elaborate documents, you know, which were time coded and marked but never, even if there was something they didn't like, did they ask me to remove it. And I think it was only after I got kind of past that hurdle,
right,
that I realized, oh, I'm actually going to do this.
It's
not going to end up in my drawer published posthumously.
Were there other people who reacted less rationally? Did you rub any feathers the wrong way? Am I allowed to ask that?
There's some parts of the book I had to suppress because I couldn't get the people who told me those things to tell me on the record.
I see.
And you can't do that.
No,
like, there
fair.
Are
yeah,
limits
the right thing,
to what's
right?
decent, you
right.
know, and indecent. And there were things that were amazing that had to. But I was told by those people, and I have it on tape, you can publish it when I die. So there will be an edition good. In 25 years
right? okay.
that has
appendix,
some really good
epilogue.
Stuff in it. And I think, to be honest, my worst crime with the characters in the book was not including so many people. And I really, it was a structural decision. It was a decision about the aesthetics of the book and the quality of the object to really make it about Kip and Ray and Ron and their narrative. And they're the architects, and they're the ones that would have gotten the Nobel Prize had Ron probably lived through September, right, of this year.
But that makes perfect sense if you're telling a narrative story rather
does.
Than telling the definitive history of everything.
I
right?
can defend the decision.
Yeah.
Do I feel a little bad? If I do, and there's sometimes people who are like a little ruffled with me.
Right.
And they're not ruffled
where's
because of
the
what I said.
About me?
Where's the chapter
yeah.
about me?
Yeah.
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 And I did get that kind of stuff. You left out all our stuff. You left out all the stuff we did. And, you know, I appreciate that. I struggled for a while. Ray and I sat down together, actually, and discussed, could we make an appendix that listed all the major players and everything that's significant that they had contributed just as an appendix of some kind? But we got into a terrible mess. Like, who do you leave off that list?
Yeah.
And then it just gets more pointed.
You're going to draw the cutting
worse,
somewhere.
Right. And so we ended up, they released to me the author list of the publication paper, and that's what the appendix is. It's the list of all the names of all the authors, the 800 some authors on the discovery paper.
So what is tell us a little bit about like what it's like
yeah.
to be a professor at Bernard in Columbia and a working research scientist.
Awesome.
But also writing books, and you have yeah. this little sideline building an empire in Brooklyn
yeah.
that you
yeah.
could tell people about.
Yeah, so I'm director of sciences at a arts center, cultural center in Brooklyn called Pioneer Works, where I'm building science studios for scientists. Sean's come and done a live event
yeah.
with me.
Yeah.
We had 500-600 people mm-hmm. at your event. That was the goddamn particle.
Yeah,
yeah, we did
right.
an event called the goddamn particle about the Higgs particle with Sean Carroll and Melissa Franklin from Harvard, who's one of the experimentalists on the Higgs. You know the story, right, that Leon Lederman originally called it the goddamn particle. And his editor was like, it might be more politic to call it the God particle. So that's how that name got foisted on us.
I think that story is not actually true.
Doesn't matter. It's my story.
I think there's the better story, which is that he called it the God particle, realized that his colleagues would look down on him,
right,
and ex post facto made up a story about
wanting to call it the goddamn particle. And that does sound like Leon Letterman. And it also sounds like him to admit it. Yeah, okay. But then he says, he has this line where he says, we managed to offend two groups, those that believe in God and those that didn't. And he said, we were warmly received by those in the middle.
Yeah.
So that is really important project, this bringing science as part of culture. We're not packaging science in anything else when we bring it to Pioneer Works. It's absolutely an art center, but we're not doing sci-art or science and art. We're doing science. They bring in great people like Sean, George Church, the geneticist, Richard Dawkins has been there. We had Werner Herzog talking about his films, like hardcore, and we get the craziest audiences. Like, our audiences are packed, standing room only, and people are loving it. And they're loving that it's being brought to their home, that they're not going to Lincoln Center,
right,
and then going, you know, that they're, it's like, they're shouting things at Richard Dawkins from the audience. like you can tell that they feel he's in their house, you know? So that's been really exciting. And then, yeah, being a professor is pretty much the greatest job imaginable, which is why it's so obnoxious that we complain and we do.
It's terrible.
I know. Ashamed of ourselves.
So you should all be thinking, because we're going to open up to questions in a few minutes. So start formulating your wonderful questions. But how's research going? What are you thinking about these
days? Yeah, so many times when I've written books, I know you've confronted this as well, people have been like, I can't believe you're taking time away from your research. And for years, I said, you don't understand, it enhances my research. I have to say, this year, it really took a hit. I'm going to admit it. I'm admitting it publicly. It was hard. Between Pioneer Works and the book tour and the whatever, it took a hit. And it's only the past couple of months I've gotten way back in, and it's such a pleasure.
I know, it's so much fun.
It's such a pleasure to work on, like, that you get lost in the math. It's like literally a psychological relief, right? It's a respite for those hours when you're totally tuned out and just So I've been working a lot on black holes related to the LIGO discovery, but black holes that create electronic circuits in these giant astrophysical systems. So you mentioned neutron stars.
Like there's wires connecting the
black
holes?
Practically like there's wires. So here's a black hole, and here's a neutron star, which, as we said, was a dead star that didn't quite become a black hole. The neutron stars can be giant magnets. They can have magnetic fields a trillion times that of the Earth, or 1,000 trillion times that of the Earth. And as it orbits the black hole, it literally, the magnetic field acts like wires. And it intersects with the black hole. And there's an experiment you can do. You can unplug a light bulb from a lamp. And if you wave a magnet around aggressively enough and strong enough magnet, you'll turn on the light bulb, even though it's not connected to an outlet.
You've done this.
I have not succeeded in doing this ever. This is a theory. Other people have succeeded in doing this. You can do it. It's easier to do with a compass needle. I've done it with a compass needle. You wave the magnet around, you can make the compass needle move. You can turn on a very weak light. To do it with a lamp light, it's a little bit hard. You got to wave very vigorously. But the idea is that if I wave a magnet around, I create a battery of sorts that runs an electrical current and turns the light bulb on without touching it or anything. Okay, and this is exactly what we're imagining. This black hole takes the magnet of the neutron star, it waves it around like crazy, and it lights up the light bulb. But what's the light bulb in this scenario? The light bulb is this atmosphere that the neutron star brings with it. And so we think we can get these bright flashes of light right before it swallows the neutron star. And they're literally electronic circuit diagrams. It's really sweet stuff. So we've been doing a lot of this electronics with black holes.
But you don't have a lab or anything?
All students? It would take is all the resources in the solar system to build one. Collapse the sun. You could probably do it with the magnet from the Large Hadron Collider.
Yeah.
And the sun, if you turn the sun into a black hole.
Then you could probably
light up Times Square. So it's like not the best investment return.
But it might help us understand some signal we see from a colliding black hole.
Okay, let's say LIGO in the future, as it's now improving its sensitivity at what we call like the higher notes, the higher frequencies, where we'll see smaller objects like neutron stars. So right now it's only hearing like the low notes, which is why it's getting all these big black holes. You know, it's like big mallets. And so at the higher frequencies, let's say LIGO records the collision of what sounds very much like a neutron star and a black hole. The only way that I know of that we could possibly also see that with a telescope would be is if it makes this electronic circuit. Right. And that last 200 milliseconds, one-fifth of a second, like we recorded in September 2015, that would be a tiny flash of light at the same time.
So whenever LIGO sees something,
the
telescopes in the world rush to point in the general direction and hope they see something.
Yes, so there's a whole network of actual telescopes that look at light that will turn in the direction that LIGO suggests they heard something from to see if there's a counterpart in a picture that can be taken. And with the two black holes, the suspicion was there would be no counterpart. There's not solid evidence for one. But if it was a black hole and a neutron star, it might be, right? So there's a lot of, like, very quick turning. The thing is just like with your ears, it's really hard to know when your phone's ringing where it's coming from. Like, you can see your phone, you know exactly where it is, but if you're just listening to it, you, like, fuffle around for a while, right? And so LIGO has very poor direction ability. It kind of says, it came from over there, like the southern sky.
Right.
And so when you tell telescopes to point that way, and they have this tiny focus, so there's, you know, the hope is it'll overlap as we get better, but right now you're trying to point very sharp focus into a very diffuse region where you're
Are we
going to
do better?
From.
Are we going to be build a better LIGO?
Yeah, so LIGO has, there's an instrument in Italy that hopefully will come online and vastly improve our ability to localize sound, like having 3 ears. And then there's LIGO India, which is being constructed, which will pinpoint even better. And as those things get better, then you're really telling telescopes where to point. And so then we might have a chance of having a picture and a sound.
That'd be pretty awesome.
That'd be pretty awesome.
And is it true what I heard that black holes that they discovered in LIGO could be dark matter?
Yeah, I mean, it's very surprising. So I was surprised by this. Were you surprised by this?
I
sort of learned. And then, you know, if you don't check it yourself, what you learn isn't always precisely right. So I always learned that you can make black holes in the Big Bang. And I've calculated some stuff about that. I know you've thought about that. And but the argument is that through Hawking's evaporation process that the black holes evaporate through a quantum process that Hawking discovered and became famous for, and oddly, the smaller they are, the faster they evaporate. So these very small black holes that were made early in the universe presumably just burnt off very rapidly. We've looked to see if there's some background light from the very early universe that might indicate that there once was these tiny black holes. The thing that I did not know is it's also possible to make them like the size of the moon.
Yeah,
I didn't know that
or the sun,
until recently.
Or, yeah.
Like, if you check the numbers, in the very early universe, you could have made black holes that were primordial. They were not the death state of stars. They were formed from the tremendous circumstances of the early universe. And they could be as planet-sized or moon-sized. And they would not evaporate away for a very long time. And they could still be around.
They would grow, right?
They would grow. They would merge and get bigger and bigger. And they could be as big as these black holes that are 30 times the mass of the sun. And so so maybe those are actually primordial forms of dark matter. They're literally dark. We can't see them. They don't reflect light. They don't emit light. And we know that there's this dark matter in the universe that's 25% of what's accountable, what we can account for in the cosmos. And maybe these primordial black holes are them.
And there could be almost as many black holes in our galaxy as there are stars, and it could be the dark matter.
Yeah, I would have thought it was more like 1%.
That's almost as many, yeah.
Okay. 100.
Right? Yeah.
About 1% of our... So we have 100 billion stars in our galaxy, and that means about 1 billion black holes by the time all is said and done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is the future? What are we looking for in the next 5, 10 years?
I'm going to LIGO this weekend. And
it's the near-term future, yes?
The very near-term future. They are opening up the chambers. They're cleaning the mirrors. So there are these big chambers that are like huge beer chambers, you know, that you could, like a beer garden, you know, you can imagine these big vats. And they drop in what are called cartridges, and the cartridges are these complex suspension systems where the mirror is very loosely hanging on the end. And the whole idea is it's very hard to shake the mirror with these complex systems. And they have to close the chamber. So once they clean the mirrors, they're going to close the chamber, and they're going to evacuate all the air from the chamber. The vacuum that exists in the 4-kilometer-long tunnels has been there, or tubes, has been there since 1998. They drew that vacuum. There's less stuff in those tubes than there is in regions of intergalactic space. They're the largest holes in the Earth's atmosphere. It's the LIGO tubes. And there were two major incidents. I'm totally digressing, but nobody really cares, right? There were two major incidents. One was a car crashed into one of the tunnels in Hanford, Washington. Hanford's on the site of
how
the original.
Does that happen?
It's a desert and it's dark. and there's this
4-kilometer long laser tube.
Yeah, so one of the security guards of the neighboring plutonium separation facility from World War II, which recently had a leak. Right.
I know. Yeah, it wasn't my fault. I wasn't.
Yeah,
there.
I'm looking at. Yeah, I'm looking
know,
at you hard,
I,
man. And I'm going there this weekend. I'm going
to
go like in a hazmat suit, right, the Geiger counter. So one of the security guards for the plutonium facility was cruising around, flying along in his Jeep, having a blast in the dark in the desert, with a poor knowledge of the local geography, and crashes into the tunnel, which is covered by cement. The actual beam tube is like 3 millimeters thick steel. It's incredibly fragile. But there's a cement tunnel, which they argued whether or not they should spend the money on.
Well.
So he crashes into the tunnel, breaking his arm, but not the LIGO arm. And if he had broken the vacuum, everybody says, that's it, we would have gone home. Would have been over.
Closed it up.
That's it. We all go home. Done. That's how hard it is and expensive it is to draw the vacuum. And it also would have been like opening a door on the space shuttle, but like the other way around, like the vacuum's on the inside of the space shuttle. He could have been killed by like opening this vent. Right. So, and then there was a gun incident in Livingston where some hunters shot up one of the tunnels.
In Louisiana?
Yeah. So I'm driving along in Louisiana. I'm being taken to the site by Gabby Gonzalez, who was the spokesperson at the time for the LIGO experiment, very high-level official scientist. And she says to me, she looks at me very reassuringly, and she says, it wasn't on purpose. And I was like, I hadn't considered the possibility
that
it was on purpose. And then someone else told me, oh, it was on purpose. Like, they were messing around with us, you know.
Yeah.
And so the head of the LIGO site is like, we're so American to our international collaborators. We have, like, a car crash. We have, like, a gun incident. He's like, all we need is, like, a hamburger incident.
Putting our best foot forward. I like it, yes. Yeah. All right, so let's see. You must have some questions around here. I believe that we have people who are carrying microphones. Yep, here's a person.
Yeah. You mentioned a gravitational wave, like a ringtone. What would that, like, you said they were like a wave.
Mm-hmm.
Were they like silent, or would they just like vibrate in your pocket a lot? Or would they just really, like, piss off your teacher?
I was really confused about whether or not, for a long time, gravitational waves were just, we were being cute and metaphorical when we were saying they were sounds. But it's more literal than that, actually. So imagine you were playing electric guitar, and you plucked the string of the electric guitar. It does not technically make a sound. That's the whole point of it. You build the body of the electric guitar to record the wave, and you play it back through an amplifier as sound. That is very much how LIGO works in a certain sense. Instead of recording a string, it's recording a three-dimensional drum of a hall of space-time. The LIGO instrument is like the body of the guitar built around the ringing wave. And it literally plays back the shape of the wave through an amplifier system. If you go to LIGO, you sit in the control room and you listen to it. It hums. And another way in which it's very much like sound, if you were an astronaut floating by the collision of those two black holes that collided 1.3 billion years ago, your ear mechanism, I mean, I haven't studied it in enough detail to swear to it, but absolutely, conceivably, could ring in response to the wave. It happens to fall in the human auditory range. LIGO is sensitive to the same frequency as the piano. And so you would be in complete darkness, but you could conceivably literally hear it, even in the absence of a medium like air. So it's much closer than a metaphor.
But you do need, in order to make detectable gravitational waves, as Jen has said, you need black hole or star-sized things. So there's no technology we're going to be developing to have pocket-sized gravitational wave detecting anytime soon.
So as I understand the story, you started working on this book, mm-hmm. and they didn't even know if this thing was possible.
Yeah.
So why did you start this book, number one? And number two, how would it have been different if they never did get that wave in the time frame that they did?
Well, I appreciate both the questions. Foolishness on all parts, basically, is like the reason. So I started writing a book. My good friend James Glick, who's a very great science writer, truly great science writer, wrote the book Chaos and Genius. And he said to me, like we're munching on appetizers, like happy hours. And he's like, don't I know everything about black holes? And I was like, do you know that they're nothing? Do you know that you can hear them? And he's like, okay. Like, that was like my approval to go forward. So I think part of it was what Sean raised earlier, that I didn't build LIGO, and I became just fascinated with the insanity of the ambition. You know this great film by Werner Herzog, Fitzcarraldo, where the guy wants to bring opera to the Amazon, and he's so obsessed that he drags the steamboat over the mountain. And you know that Herzog dragged a steamboat over the mountain to make the film? Like, it's these layers of insanity, basically. To me, it was that story. That's what it was about. It wasn't about it succeeding or not succeeding. It was about the obsessive campaign to drag a steamship over a mountain because you believed in this creative endeavor and it had taken like a hold of your mind. And that's what I felt like with Ray and with Kip and with Ron and to different levels of mental balance. and that's what the book was about. It didn't matter. In fact, when Ray was like, what are you going to do if we like succeed or we detect something? And I had the same story for him. I was like, I could never have written the book with the tension, the anxiety, you know, the sort of weight of not knowing if you succeed. And that's really what the book is about. It's about the ambition. Ray started this when he was a young man in 1972. He's 80-something now, and he's there all the time, on site, walking the tunnels, taking care of the instrument, finding the sources of noise. I cannot tell you the number of times somebody would say to me, like, we better ask Ray, you know? And I think that's what the book was about. And so when the discovery happened, I told Ray in the months before, oh, I would write an epilogue. I'd be thrilled to get in an epilogue, but I wouldn't rewrite the book. And so they told me quite early to give me a chance to write the epilogue.
But it's a feature of science, right? Like, these guys didn't become better scientists the day they discovered the gravitational waves. They were great scientists doing great things, whether or not they found anything.
Yes.
And you never know whether nature's going to cooperate.
No, and I think that it's become very oppressive within the sciences. The fear of being wrong or failing has become oppressive, and that we need to remember that the greatest things were done with a tremendous amount of risk.
All right, is there another question over there?
Can I take one right?
Yes.
I really admired the fine level of detail in your book as you're reporting. Mm-hmm. And just as a detail about Ray, could you tell us about the Black Widows at Hanford?
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Liz. So Ray was the first person to walk the tunnels. So you have to imagine what they're like. They're 4 kilometer long, about a meter and a half stainless steel, very, very thin tubes, and that has the vacuum and the laser light. Between that tube and the outside is this cement structure. And so you can walk down this very dank, dark, long, 4 kilometer long tunnel between the stainless steel and between the cement. And Ray was the first person to walk that 4 kilometer-long stretch in like a decade or something. And he did it because they were worried that there were leaks in the vacuum. And as I've said, the vacuum turns out to be incredibly precious and expensive and difficult. And so a leak in the vacuum could be the end. And what he found was this infestation of black widows what they do is, well, first of all, the problem was is that the black widow's urine and the urine of the mice and things like that contain a lot of chlorine, and it turns out that stainless steel is not stainless to chlorine. you can't make a stainless steel pool, swimming pool. So it was creating, it was eating into the tube and creating these tiny leaks that he found. And he found these, but he would go, I mean, Ray would talk about this for like an hour. They would make these hexagonal webs, and they would like put the rodents, or I don't know what they eat. What did they find? What were they eating? I don't even remember. And they would like leave them there.
Lasers, apparently.
Until they became, like, and then, right. And this infestation was what was causing like a major problem in the experiment. And this was typical of what they were encountering over the 20 years. So the first facility was built in the year 2000. So between 1972 and 2000, they spend just designing it. They build it in the year 2000. It's the first 15 years of the first generation. And in 2015 is when they start the advanced machines. And so in all of that time, there's no detections, but the experiment's like beautiful gold star technological achievement. And but they all of these subtle problems I had along the way were completely unexpected things like urine from wasps. Oh, that's what it was. The black widows were eating the wasps. That's right. So they were trapping the wasps in these hexagonal, elaborate... He was fascinated. He would spend hours in the tubes afterwards. I was like, you know, Ray, pay attention. Fix the plugs. You know, fix the leaks.
They don't
stay
teach
focused.
You. It's very real. Like, yeah. You know, when I was writing about the Large Hadron Collider, there was a famous incident where it was shut down because a pigeon was carrying a piece of baguette and dropped it into an electrical transformer. And, you know, that's not the... You didn't take a class in that in graduate school, but you got to fix it, right?
Yeah.
Are there any other questions over here?
Thank you. Hi. So now that we confirm gravitational waves by the LIGO instrument, what about gravitons? Or is that dealing into more of the quantum mechanics field?
It is definitely related more to the quantum mechanics field. And what we're looking at is super low energy, nowhere near the quantum regime. So, you know, we can talk about light as having a wave property or photons having a quantum particle-like property. And yes, you can do the same thing with gravitational waves, that they have a quantum particle-like counterpart. But we are nowhere near probing that with gravitational waves. These systems are... You have to think of quantum mechanics as probing really high energy in really small scales. These are like big lumbering things. They're huge, you know, and in comparison to the quantum scale. I mean, the black holes that collided were only a couple hundred kilometers across,
right,
even though they weighed 30 times the sun. So they were about 200 kilometers across, and they were going around each other near the speed of light. So that final one-fifth of a second, they did a few orbits.
Right.
They were going that fast. But it's still, none of that goes near probing the quantum scale. Do you have anything to say about gravitons?
Yeah, I mean, gravitons probably exist, the particles of gravity that are the quantum version of the gravitational waves. But we'll never detect a single graviton just because gravity is too weak of a force. There's probably gravitons going through your body right now.
Yeah.
You'll never, ever know.
Here's
that doesn't mean they're not there.
Of how weak gravity is. The whole Earth is pulling on me. I got no problem.
And even little old you.
All
right.
The whole Earth.
Another question?
Yes, right over here.
You mentioned that the signal was about a fifth of a second.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a physical correlate to what's happened with the black holes crashing during that time? Is that related to like a single period of the wave?
You
know, how do we know how far away it happened and how do you know how massive they were?
Right. So all of this about how far away, how massive, is all about listening to the ringing drum and reconstructing the shape and size of the mallets banging on the drum. And that's the whole game. And I can literally do it in an orchestra. Technically, if I record the wave of a drum and I should be able to reconstruct exactly what the mallets are doing and how big they are and how fast they were moving. And so that's how we reconstruct that they were 200 kilometers across and how heavy they were. How far away, you know, we say 1.3 billion light years away, but plus or minus a couple hundred million years. Like that, we don't have great distance estimates yet. They're still off by quite a bit. But to your other question, what was your other question? About how, why the one-fifth of a second? So presumably those black holes were orbiting each other. It could have been for a billion years or more. Okay? I mean, think about what was happening. Since the formation of the Earth, those black holes might have been in orbit around each other. Probably best guess, although there's these other competing theories, they were two stars that collapsed, become very massive black holes in ways that we didn't appreciate were possible before, but now we're learning are. and those two stars became black holes, and they were in orbit around each other, and they spent a billion years slowly winding together. You know, by the time Einstein came along, you know, they were, I don't know, probably, maybe thousands of kilometers apart, but probably not much more than that. And then over the course of the 100 years since Einstein writes down general relativity, they're getting closer and closer and closer. By the year 2000, they're 15 years from merger, right?
And well, you mean the year 2000 minus a billion years?
Minus a billion years.
Right, because yeah. They're a billion light years away.
Yeah, set right. T equals zero at yeah. minus a billion. And yes, exactly. And so by the year 2000, the waves from when they were 15 years from merger were hitting the Earth. It's be the right. best That's way of right. saying it. And then it's still too quiet to ring the instrument. As superb as that first generation of instruments was, it's just too quiet. It's not until that final 1/5 of a second that it gets loud enough. Like you imagine the percussionist banging harder, faster, louder, that it gets loud enough. And it's a real spike. It's only then that it gets loud enough that the machine can record it. And then it just spikes right above the noise.
So I think multiple periods?
It was about four or five orbits. Of final orbits going between a seventh the speed of light and more than a half the speed of light and covering 200 kilometers in you know, this
It seems very lucky when you think they were orbiting for a billion years and they gave off these gravitational waves, and the gravitational waves traveled for a billion years, and there's 1/5 of a second of their duration, and it happened just when we turned it on, right? But, of course, what this means is there's probably many, many black hole events throughout the universe scattered, and they're passing through us all the time, and that's what we hope the future will hold.
There's three events that LIGO has announced. There was another one on December 26th of that same year, Boxing Day, to a black hole collision, and there was another one that was not as golden as the others. It was a little more hidden, but looks pretty good. So far it's been all black holes all the time.
All right, two more questions I think we're going to get.
Yes, I remember reading that LIGO can only detect black holes in a range of masses, and like the super big ones that cannot see them.
That's right.
Why is that? And are there plans to make different detectors that can see a different range of masses?
Yeah, you should think of the frequency, the low or high quality of the notes as being related to the size of the system. And so on the very, very low end is where LIGO's making all its detections right now. And there's a specific reason for that. That's because that's where the instrument's the best. Okay, it's still having trouble at the higher frequencies. So there's probably neutron stars colliding and that LIGO just isn't hearing them because it's not sensitive enough yet. So LIGO cuts off at these black holes around the, let's just say, roughly 50 times the mass of the sun range. Then they get too low for LIGO to detect. They fall off the piano range. And so we know that there's a black hole in the center of our own galaxy that's 4 million times the mass of the sun, and we believe that these big supermassive black holes collide and that they'll be ringing spacetime at the very low notes. And so LISA is an experiment proposed for space that will do something very similar to LIGO. It will suspend mirrors, but in these very small shielded spacecraft and separated by millions of kilometers, and it will pick up very low notes. So you think of the size of the system is marking how low you can hear the notes, which are coming from bigger systems. So like any instrument, it only has a range that it can hear, basically. Just like the human ear. There's stuff that falls off. I drove myself crazy. When they told me about the detection, I immediately went and tried to simulate the sound, because I run a lot of, smash black holes together for fun on a computer, and I can make the sounds, predict the sounds, and I could not hear it. It was driving me insane. Turns out your computer speakers aren't good enough to play the low notes. Like, you need like a subwoofer.
Good
so
to know.
I drove myself insane like overnight for like two nights in a row before Rana Adhikari, one of the experimentalists, is like, you can't hear it through your computer.
All right, one more question.
Did you say that it was September 2014 or 2015 that the first 1/5 second gravitational waves were detected?
It was 2015.
It was 2015.
I have that right? The experiment, the name of the event is 09-14-15, which marks the date. And the other one was 12-26-15, which was Boxing Day. There was one in between that was the one that was quieter.
And we're going to be getting more?
Presumably we're going to be getting more when LIGO wants to make an announcement. We'll see what they say.
All right. Well, this was so much fun. Thank you all very much for coming. Thank you, Jana.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.